Montgomery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and that book will be the focal point of our discussion. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you.
As we're speaking on 12-5-04, there is a lot of public discussion about the questionable election results here in the United States. There's been a fair amount of controversy. You have certainly covered that in the on your consortiumnews.com website and been lambasted by, among others, the Washington Post for doing so. But one of the points that you make in Secrecy and Privilege is that the Republican Party has a long history of dirty tricks, in particular, dirty tricks in presidential election years. This past presidential election year saw a major focus on the Vietnam War, an event long past, but because of George Bush's role in the Texas Air National Guard and John Kerry's role as a war hero, it came into sharp focus again. It's sort of ironic, but one of the things that you talk about in Secrecy and Privilege is the interference on the part of the Nixon campaign with some peace talks that might have at least attenuated the conflict, if not ended it. I wonder if you would go into that in some detail for us.
Well, sure. In 1968, of course, there was a fairly tight race between Richard Nixon and Vice President Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey was trying to succeed his president, Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson had been forced out of the race himself because of the Vietnam War and his failure to prosecute it effectively. But he was trying to bring it to some kind of conclusion before the election in 1968. There was an effort to have all sides get together in Paris for peace talks. Johnson was hopeful that this would be a breakthrough, that he'd be able to bring the war to some kind of conclusion. Obviously, that also might have helped Humphrey in this close race. So it was to Nixon's disadvantage to have those peace talks go forward. Now, all that was sort of known at the time, and we also knew that the peace talks collapsed. They collapsed because the South Vietnamese government, the government of President Chu, had refused to attend them. So while the communist side was willing to attend them, and Johnson wanted to have them, the Saigon allies balked, and the peace talks collapsed. Nixon was able to eke out a very, very narrow victory over Humphrey, and really, in a sense, change the direction of American politics for years to come. Now, at the time, although the American people didn't know this, the Johnson people did know that there were back-channel communications going from the Nixon campaign to the Saigon government. Often they were being handled largely by Anna Chenault, who was a Chinese American and who was working for the Nixon campaign. And her message to the Saigon regime was that if they held off and didn't cooperate with Johnson, that the Nixon administration would give them a better deal. And clearly, from the point of view of the Saigon regime, which only was standing up because of U.S. backing, the idea that any kind of peace talks probably would have led to their collapse. So President Chu agreed not to show up, and the war went on for another 4 or 5 years. Now, since then, more and more details have come out. The first real break in the story came when Cy Hirsch did his book on Henry Kissinger. And he included a section on these 1968 dealings because Henry Kissinger played a background role for it on Nixon's behalf. Since then, additional material has come out. There were documents, there were intercepts of the Saigon, of the South Vietnamese embassies, messages back and forth to Saigon that were made public in the 1990s. And so as bits and pieces of the story have emerged, what we've learned is that Nixon was willing to play with the lives of 500,000 American soldiers who were on the ground in South Vietnam for political advantage. And that although Johnson got wind of this, he did not make it public at the time, partly because he didn't have the whole story, and partly because the fear was that since Nixon won, to bring this all out would have caused great dissension within the United States. So the Democrats largely kept quiet. Some of them have talked about it since, but really not until many years after the fact. And so the American people really don't know this whole story. And fairly recently, when Vice President Ki, who was the South Vietnamese vice president, did his memoirs, he also included a segment on this initiative from the Republicans to get the Saigon government to pull out of the peace talks. As a result, some 30,000 American soldiers died, along with many tens of thousands of Vietnamese and Indochinese people. So this was a case of absolute determination to put gaining power in the United States ahead of even the well-being of American troops.
It's interesting to ruminate on that. 30,000 would put more than half of the total combat deaths. The people whose names are up on that brave moving wall fell after these peace negotiations were sabotaged.
Right.
Something you note, I would add just in passing, that this, something of a pattern has obtained that when these Republican abuses, or I would say at least outright treason, take place, very frequently the Democrats play the good scout, and they decide in the interest of national unity and patriotism, etc., to keep quiet. And then yet the Democrats get portrayed as the traitors and the Republicans as the patriots, and that is, shall we say, a less than complete picture.
It is ironic, and it has been a pattern that you can trace back to 68, and it recurs as in Secrecy and Privilege. I show that a number of Democrats have played this role. Even during the Watergate period, there were senior Democrats who were trying to sweep the Watergate scandal under the rug, in the name of national unity and not to have that go forward. There were enough Democrats who did fight for the truth. And of course, the courts intervened as well. So, a good deal of the truth about Watergate was forced out and Nixon was, forced to resign. But the pattern has continued, and we see Democrats choosing not to bring out some of the dirty tricks that the Republicans have played out of fear that it will undermine the confidence the American people may have in the electoral process, or it might cause dissension within the government and prevent them from getting certain bills passed. There always seems to be some reason, some excuse, not to simply get the facts out and tell the American people the truth.
One of the personalities that you chronicle throughout the course of roughly two or three decades of American political activity in connection with this is a guy named Spencer Oliver. And he actually noted that the Clinton administration just basically was very naive and they didn't realize who the people were that they were keeping in power and what they would do. Spencer Oliver crops up in connection with the Watergate affair. Now, in 1968, we just covered the Nixon campaign's interference with the peace talks between the Johnson administration and the Vietnamese. 4 years later, once again, there was subterfuge with regard to the presidential election campaign. And you go into a lawsuit that followed the Watergate affair's exposure and how this obtained to an attempt by the Nixon administration to see to it that George McGovern's weak candidacy would not be derailed. That's kind of a tortuous way of putting it, but I wonder if you would highlight the Texas connection, or the Texas gambit, we might say, and Spencer Oliver and how this obtained to the Watergate lawsuit.
Well, Spencer Oliver is an interesting character. He plays a key role in Secrecy and Privilege because he crops up in a number of these moments. And his role during the Watergate period was he was the one guy who was working for the Democratic Party at Watergate whose phone was actually bugged. What happened in Watergate was that the Nixon burglars went in. They went in first in May of 1972 to place wiretaps on a couple of phones. One of the phones they chose was Spencer Oliver, who was a young staffer. And the other one was a tap to be placed on the phone for the Democratic National Chairman. Now, the only bug that worked was the one on Oliver's phone. So they were picking up information that he was involved in. Some personal stuff they picked up. His marriage was breaking up, so they had a lot of gossip about him. But they also found out that he was part of an effort by some moderate Democrats to try to head off McGovern's then growing chances of victory. If we look back at the whole Watergate scandal, part of it was that Nixon wanted to sabotage what he considered the strongest Democrats, the ones who might give him trouble, people like Ed Muskie, and sort of funnel the Democrats into the weakest candidates, including George McGovern. So Nixon was really wanting to match up against McGovern. The efforts among some of the more establishment Democrats like Oliver was to see if other choices could be made to avoid the McGovern choice and to have a Democrat who might have a better chance to beat Nixon. So that's what the Republicans were picking up on the bug in Oliver's phone. And part of the strategy at that time was to go to Texas, where there was going to be a convention, a state convention, to pick delegates for the Democrats, and try to prevent McGovern from getting any delegates from Texas. So that was what Oliver was discussing with other Democrats. But when he went down to Texas thinking that he'd have a pretty easy time of trying to shut out McGovern, what he encountered were Democrats who were close to John Connally, who had been the former governor, who were urging that McGovern be given his fair share of delegates. And so this plan was destroyed. And Oliver ran into Bob Strauss, who was a senior Democrat at the time, who was also close to Connally. Connally had switched over by this point from being a Democrat to being part of the Nixon administration, and was actually heading up some of the Democrats for Nixon in 72. So you had here this strange situation that Oliver couldn't understand at the time, because they seemed like they knew what was coming. And so the pro-Connally Democrats were essentially handing the nomination to McGovern in Oliver's view. So he didn't know what to make of that, but it's what happened. And he then, a month or so later, finds out that there's been this break-in at the Democratic National Committee. There was a second break-in. The first break-in had gone undetected. The second break-in was to make sure that some of the bugs that weren't working began to work. They wanted to place more in and to fix the ones that weren't working. And that was the moment in June of 1972 when the burglars were caught and the scandal began to erupt. At first, though, for quite some time, it was not known that there actually had been a prior break-in, and that there had been intelligence being gleaned off of at least one of the phones in the Democratic National Committee, Oliver's phone. It wasn't until so subsequently it's learned that there was this earlier break-in, and Oliver becomes a key figure then, both in the lawsuit that the Democrats tried to bring against the Republicans for this espionage. Essentially a wiretap violation, and he comes under pressure later, after Nixon wins his landslide victory in 72, Bob Strauss, the Texas Democrat, wins a nasty battle inside the Democratic Party to become the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Strauss then turns around and begins to pressure Oliver into withdrawing from the Watergate lawsuit. Strauss wants to end the Watergate lawsuit, and he wants to essentially make amends with the Republicans. He moves the Democratic Party out of the Watergate because he doesn't want to remind people of the incident. He's acting in ways that would seem quite unusual if you looked at it from the point of view of what's good for the Democrats in a partisan way. He's acting really to help out the Republicans. Simultaneous, by the way, to Strauss's emergence as the Democratic National Chairman, Nixon turns to a former Texas congressman named George H.W. Bush to become the Republican National Chairman. And Bush and Strauss, both Texans, both well connected into that world, and both of whom have relations with John Connally, the two of them begin working on this effort to sweep the Watergate scandal under the rug. Ultimately it fails. Oliver refuses to go along. He is then forced out of his job with the Democratic Party, and is punished for not acceding to these requests to help the Republicans protect their flanks on Watergate. And Strauss continues to try to settle this matter even into 1974, when the story is really beginning to unfold. But then the Urban Committee in the Senate has examined this. John Dean has come forward and made public statements. And the story is beginning to unravel in ways that nobody can really control anymore. And despite the best efforts of George Bush Sr. and Bob Strauss and others, the truth finally comes out, at least to a great degree, and Nixon is forced to resign.
This did, however, put George Bush right into the mix, and was one of a number of examples of George Bush's helping to orchestrate not only some of the machinations that subverted the electoral process, but also the cover-up of the same. 8 years later, in 1980, of course, there was another gambit, something called the October Surprise. We touched on that in our first interview, Robert. I wonder if you would encapsulate the October Surprise, give us delineate the outlines of that investigation or gambit, and then talk about why that didn't come out. Because you relate a very interesting series of individuals and facts that indicate that, in fact, the people who were investigating or quote investigating October Surprise were conflicted. They had conflicts of interest which attenuated the investigation.
Right. Well, again, in 1980, the Republicans, well, first after Watergate, in 1974, the Republicans were dealt a serious defeat. They were clobbered in the Congress. By 1976, with the defeat of Gerald Ford, who was seeking to win the presidency on his own, they lost essentially all the positions in the government. They were out of the Congress. The Democrats of the House, the Senate, and the White House. So that was a very low moment for the Republicans, and they began their efforts to rebuild their strength, largely or in part by bringing together conservative media and other means to make their case more effectively, to attack reporters. There were all kinds of new groups being formed at that time, which had become very powerful in the years since. But by the time we get to 1980, Jimmy Carter, the Democratic president, has been struggling through a number of crises. There have been oil shocks. There have been high inflation. The economy is not doing too well. But one of the issues that is on everybody's mind at the time is the seizure of American hostages in Iran, which occurred in November of 1979. The efforts by the Carter administration to get those hostages out become a focus of almost a national obsession through 1980. There's an effort to mount a rescue operation in April 1980, which fails. There are renewed talks at different points, especially in September of 1980. And ultimately those do not work. The hostages remain in through the election of 1980. Actually, the anniversary of the hostages being taken happens to be the same day as the election in 1980. And Reagan defeats Carter, and of course his vice president is George H.W. Bush. The hostages are finally released on January 20th, 1981, literally minutes after Ronald Reagan takes the oath of office. Now, despite the peculiar coincidences here, people did not really make much of this for some time. It wasn't really until the Iran-Contra scandal began to break, which I was involved in writing about for the Associated Press in 1985 and 86, that there begins to be a focus on, well, when did these contacts with the Iranians really begin for the Republicans? And as we learn more and more, we discovered that the contacts actually went back to 1980. And by early 81, shortly after the Reagan presidency began, literally days, the shipments of weapons begin to go to Iran. This did not just begin in 1985 as we had initially thought, but really can be dated back to the very first days of the Reagan administration, often being handled through the Israelis, It actually was an Israeli plane that was shot down over the Soviet Union carrying weapons, American weapons, to the Iranians. And it was, at the time, essentially covered up, at least in terms of the significance of it. So we have this, we learn these facts. The question becomes, well, how did they start and who started them? And some of these stories began to spill out. There have been about maybe 24 or so witnesses of various types who have spoken about their various roles in these contacts. Some of them are reasonably credible. Some of them are fairly prominent, including senior officials of the Iranian government, people in the PLO, including Yasser Arafat, the head of French intelligence, Alexander Desmarais, as well as people who were sort of less known but who were more players on the ground, an Israeli intelligence officer, for instance. And so if you look at the body of this evidence, it's actually fairly significant. And what we have pieced together, and what I tried to go through now in some more detail in Secrecy and Privilege, is to lay out the evidence and the facts and the chronology of how this thing unfolded, and bringing in much of this new evidence, including much of it now, which is now documented even, including testimony that was given before a House panel, which was basically kept secret, and a report even from the Russian government, which chimed in with a report which was kept secret from the American people as well, saying that indeed the U.S. government, the Republicans, had engaged in secret contacts with the Iranians back in 1980. So the basic storyline, as it has emerged, is that it appears that the initial motivation of the Republicans in the early part of 1980 was to find out what was going on. Bill Casey had been appointed the head of the Reagan campaign, and he was a former spy master from World War II, and a person who just wanted to know as much as he could to avoid any surprises that might hit him in the campaign he was running. So he basically begins making contacts. He knows there was a business associate named John Shaheen, who also had been a former spy from World War II and still close to the CIA, who had this Iranian business associate named Cyrus Hashemi, who happened to be a person that Carter was using to help try to arrange the release of the hostages. So there's this back channel that was set up through Casey and John Shaheen and Cyrus Hashemi to begin not just spying effectively on what Carter was up to, but allegedly making his own set of contacts with the Iranian leadership. We also know that on the side of George H.W. Bush, who was first running for president against Reagan and then became his vice presidential nominee, Bush used people who had been in the CIA, because Bush had been CIA director in 1976, and had gotten very close to a number of CIA officers who were cashiered effectively during the Carter administration, who were very bitter and wanted to get payback, in effect. So some of them, including Ted Shackley, the legendary blonde ghost of a number of prominent CIA operations of the 60s and 70s, was one of Bush's operatives who was making his own set of contacts and finding out what was going on. So those efforts, which were essentially intelligence gathering initially, evolve over the summer of 1980 into a relationship with the Iranians that seeks either to settle this matter early and therefore make it not an issue before the election in November of 80, or as things drag on, to make sure that Carter is not able to get the hostages out right before the election. And now the evidence is overwhelming, I would say, it's certainly very strong, that kind of understanding did evolve with the Iranians and the Republicans over those months, and eventually was settled when after Reagan came in. By then, the terms had been pretty well nailed down, partly in the post-election contacts with the Carter people. But the Iranians were then willing to let the hostages out as long as Carter got no credit for it, and they handed them over essentially to Reagan, and made, and it was an important boost for the early Reagan-Bush years to have this patriotic surge that followed the release of the hostages. And Reagan was able to present it as if the Iranians were scared of him. There was the joke that was going around Washington, basically, what's 2 feet deep and glows in the dark? And the joke was that that's Tehran, you know, a minute after Ronald Reagan becomes president. So that it helped create this image of Ronald Reagan as someone who was tough, who didn't take, who instilled fear in our enemies, and could get things done. And that was very important as a way to give the Reagan-Bush administration momentum as it went into its foreign policy initiatives of the 1980s.
This is something, this October surprise is something that's delineated at considerable length in your book. So listeners who would like to flesh out some of the details and see exactly how this was done, hearing about people such as J. Stanley Pottinger, one of Hashemi's associates, and also a good friend of George Bush, can get a very detailed presentation of this in the October surprise discussion, that portion of Secrecy and Privilege. Robert, we're almost out of time on this side. What I'd like to do is we'll begin side two with discussion of how this got covered up. It's certainly one would imagine that something of this importance, certainly the fixing of an election and I would say treason, would come out, and yet it didn't, and there are reasons for that. I'm going to give some information about some of the websites in which people can hear this interview and get the description of it. But tell us about your website. Tell us about Secrecy and Privilege in this holiday shopping season. Where can people order the book?
Well, there is a way to go to a direct website for the book. It's called secrecyandprivilege.com. It's one word, Secrecy and Privilege. And there are some details about the book, information about the book, and as well as a way to order it directly online. It's also available through Amazon.com. And it's offered by some bookstores, but it has not gotten wide distribution in the bookstores, so it's probably easiest to get it online. Also at consortiumnews.com, which is the website that I've been involved with since the mid-1990s, as a place for investigative journalism. People can go there and connect through to get the book.
All righty, and I want to remind listeners of the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. There are long descriptions of all of the programs and lectures available that I've done over the years. In particular, in the For the Record section, there are long annotated article-length descriptions of each For the Record program. Also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent For the Record programs, roughly the last 4 years or so, are archived on Streaming Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only. Also on Real Audio at a longer URL, link to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, again at www.spitfirelist.com. We've been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. We will be joining Robert again in side two of this program, and we're going to continue with our discussion of the October surprise and why this hasn't made more of a splash than it has. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 1 of For the Record program number 481. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. And again, my name is Dave Emery, and thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry. Once again, this has been recorded on December 5th of 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to welcome back to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and that's the focal point of this broadcast. Robert, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, we've been talking about the October surprise, the gambit through which the Reagan-Bush campaign sabotaged the peace negotiations to release the U.S. hostages that had been taken from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in November of 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. This also provided a major propaganda boost for the incoming Reagan administration, which was able to spin this as a result of the Iranians' fear of the incoming tough cowboy Ronald Reagan. One of the things you go into in Secrecy and Privilege is how the people that were, quote, investigating, unquote, and please note the quotes, the October surprise actually had profound conflicts of interest, which contributed in a major way to the cover-up, effectively, of this. I wonder if you detail that for us.
Well, sure. To understand what happened with the October surprise investigation that went back to the 1980-ish time frame, and also understand what happened to the Iran-Contra investigation. The Iran-Contra scandal finally breaks out in the fall of 1986, and we find out at that point that there have been secret operations, some of which, few of us in the press corps, I was at AP at the time, doing a lot of the work on especially the Contra side of the operation. But we find out in the fall of 86 that there were these secret dealings that had been going on involving George Bush, the vice president, Ronald Reagan, William Casey, the CIA director, some of the same characters who we'll go back to and see in the 1980 issue, but they are playing key roles as well in the Iran-Contra affair as it breaks apart in the fall of 86. Very soon after that, however, because of the tone, the mood of Washington, which was first of all, that Reagan had won a big re-election in 84, there was a strong sentiment not to have another Watergate. And it wasn't just from the Republicans, who had been really working hard in terms of building their own institutions, their own news organizations, to try to protect any future Republican president from having another Watergate. But there was also hesitancy among Democrats to have another Watergate, that is, have a constitutional crisis that might force the impeachment or the forced resignation of a second Republican president. The press corps felt, surprisingly, maybe to some, much the same way. In the Washington Post company, which I went to work for at Newsweek, there was a strong sense that we don't want to go through that again. It was not as, some of the people might think that it's a great thrill to be involved in those kinds of scandal stories, but there's an awful lot of pain that goes into them, and Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, was not eager to go through it again. She'd gotten to be very good friends with the Reagans. She really didn't want to see this. And that was a feeling that was fairly broadly felt across Washington. So there was the idea that in dealing with the Iran-Contra affair that it should be basically minimized, that it should not go the full way, that there should not be full exposure of the criminality of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And so that's pretty much what occurred. There was an effort to put the blame on a few fall guys, Oliver North, John Poindexter, William Casey, who had fallen ill with cancer in late 1986 and died in May of 87. So those folks were sort of set aside as the people who would take the principal blame. And the whole story would be presented as these guys had gone out of control, they'd done their own rogue operation. That wasn't true. We now know historically through the investigations that occurred subsequently that the Iran-Contra affair was handled and improved by Ronald Reagan. George Bush Sr. had been a principal operative in it, that the CIA institutionally had been deeply involved and implicated. So it wasn't the story that was being dealt as and presented to the American people in 1987 was not the truth. It was not really the full truth. So when we come out of that period, toward the end of it, as people start looking back at the origins of how the Republicans made contact with the Iranians, we start going back in time, and we start going back to the very beginning of the Reagan administration and finding out about secret shipments of weapons that were done in 81, and we go back to 1980 and begin to find out that there were these curious contacts and negotiations that people were alleging. And a large number of people, really up to two dozen or so, people were describing different aspects of these contacts and dealings. So we begin to see that this was not something that just sort of popped up in the middle of the 1980s. It was something that had gone back to the Reagan campaign. However, the mood in Washington was not to pursue Iran-Contra very far, and it was certainly not to pursue these earlier issues hard at all. And there were problems with the story, too. There was one fellow who came forward who began talking, who inserted disinformation, a guy named Oswald the Winter. He had pretended to be a source for some people, and he knew some things about the 1980 activities, but he also included information that could be shown to be false. When I interviewed him later for Public Broadcasting's Frontline program, I got him to admit that he had been spreading disinformation. He said then that he had been paid by CIA officers and operatives to insert this kind of information as a way to discredit the whole story. You had people like this who were creating problems, and then you had the conservative press corps that would pounce on those kinds of problems and make it very difficult for anyone trying to get to the truth. Combined with that, you had when there was pressure finally to get an investigation going, and it really took off or began to be looked at more seriously by 1991 and 92. You had people who were put in charge of those investigations who really didn't want to get to the truth. They were more concerned about making things work. The lead Democrat was Lee Hamilton, who had been one of the people involved in the Iran-Contra investigation in the 80s and was one of the Democrats who didn't want to have it go too far. He then is made the head of the investigation in of October Surprise in 91 and 92, along with Henry Hyde, who's a very aggressive Republican trying to maintain to protect then-President Bush, who was at the center of this possible new scandal. And President Bush himself makes statements almost out of the blue, coming at a couple of press conferences, denying that he's involved with the October Surprise case. So there are a lot of reasons not to pursue it politically in Washington. You have, and then you have Lee Hamilton picking as the chief investigator a lawyer named Larry Barcella. And Barcella was had come forward and volunteered for the job, but he also was a lawyer who had worked for some of the people who would be under investigation. He had been a key lawyer for BCCI, the corrupt Middle Eastern bank. And BCCI is part of this story because it was funneling some of the money that was going to some of the key players, including this Iranian named Cyrus Hashemi, who was allegedly a double agent pretending to work for the Carter administration, but also working for the Reagan campaign. So you had a number of problems of that sort. You had Democrats who were not eager to get to the truth, and you had Republicans who were determined to protect George H.W. Bush. And you had a press corps that had lost interest in all these Iran-Contra issues years earlier and tended to laugh at this kind of story, as they had laughed at stories like the Contra drug trafficking story, which, of course, turned out to be true, but was mocked during the 1980s. It was mocked when it came back in the 1990s. And even when the CIA admitted to the Contra drug trafficking stories in 1998, the major news media, which had put them down in the 80s and earlier in the 90s, essentially ignored these admissions. So you had this climate in Washington that was not aggressive in trying to get to the bottom of these kinds of complex issues. So that was why I think, as much as anything, there was not a willingness to pursue and find out the real facts. And I think the evidence is now pretty overwhelming that there were Republican contacts with the Iranians, and that those contacts led to interference with Carter's hostage negotiations in 1980. Some of the people that have come forward, by the way, include Yasser Arafat, who acknowledged to President Carter in the 1990s during a meeting that they had in Gaza that he had been approached by the Republicans who had wanted him to act as an intermediary with the Iranians. And the PLO had said that they had, when they went to Iran, it turned out that the Iranians already had contacts with the Republicans, so the PLO intercession was not was not necessary, and Arafat said he didn't act on this Republican request. But it shows that there were a lot of channels that the Republicans are trying to open to deal with the Iranians directly. We also have this remarkable report that the Russian government gave to this House Task Force that was run by Lee Hamilton and Henry Hyde. And the Russian report, which they were asked to provide, said that that according to their intelligence files, the Republicans, including Casey and Bush, had made contact and had dealings with the Iranians in the summer and fall of 1980, and that they had struck a deal. And that the Russians also reported that their intelligence showed that Carter was doing some things which none of us had known about either, by the way, although Carter then was the president and certainly had the legal authority to do so. So what we end up with is a lot of evidence pointing to this very important moment in American history. And the American people have been essentially been denied these facts. And so I spend several chapters in Secrecy and Privilege trying to lay out the evidence in a chronological fashion, which I'd never done before. I'd sort of always dealt with this somewhat piecemeal because as we had gotten the material. But what I do in this book for the first time is sort of show how the story begins and the powerful personalities and the vast sums of money that are at play starting in 79, even before the hostages are taken, but after the Shah of Iran falls and the Khomeini regime takes over, and the way these relationships with powerful Republicans evolve, and the sums of money that are being moved around, often covertly through secret bank accounts, it's a remarkable tale of how power and politics really work in the United States. It's not what I think many folks in Washington want the American people to know much about.
One of the things that's on the current political stage is the revamping of the Central Intelligence Agency under Porter Goss, not only a veteran of the Caribbean covert operations of the 60s himself, but a Republican partisan. And there's been a lot of speculation that there have been, as we're speaking on December 5th of 2004, a great many resignations, perhaps forced resignations from the CIA, and there's been a lot of discussion. In fact, Porter Goss has actually been very explicit in saying that the agency should support the president and that it should be a secret agency, the thrust being that the agency is being politicized in a direction that will further reinforce the viewpoints and policies of the Bush administration. One of the things that you go into in Secrecy and Privilege is that the politicization of intelligence, and in particular the corruption of the CIA's analytical division, particularly with regard to the Soviet Union, was a long process. And one of the major elements in this was the elder George Bush's ushering in of a Team B. I wonder if you would trace for us, because we've got about 15 minutes left in the broadcast, maybe a little less, the evolution of this politicization of intelligence from the elder George Bush's term at the CIA and the ushering in of Team B through William Casey's acceleration of that same process in the 1980s, and if time permits, also getting George Tenet's accession to the CIA and his relationship with David Boren.
Well, this is all very important because what we're dealing with today is a perversion of the information upon which the U.S. government functions. And that's not just some abstract or academic concept. It has led directly to the war in Iraq and the deaths of over 1,200 American soldiers and possibly tens of thousands of Iraqis. So when information is falsified or spun or politicized, that can have real consequences and dangerous consequences. So it's important to know how we got there, and it's important to know what the CIA was about. And people often misunderstand the CIA. It's really divided into two parts. There's the operational section, which includes paramilitary kinds of secret war, if you will, and spying. And then there's the analytical division, which is supposed to take the evidence that's available in a fairly academic way, objectively, and refine it and present to the policymakers in the government the most accurate, the most unvarnished facts possible so they can make the best decisions possible. But this has often been controversial because you have strong-willed presidents at times. But the CIA's analytical division, which was, of course, founded in the 40s, has always taken pride in telling presidents what they don't want to hear, whether it was Eisenhower's bomber gap that he was complaining about, which the agency said didn't exist, or Kennedy's missile gap, which the agency said didn't exist, to telling LBJ during the Vietnam War that his bombing of North Vietnam wasn't as effective as he thought it was. So there's always been this history. And we see this history going on through the 70s. And then there's a key point in the mid-1970s when the conservatives, who are then coalescing around Ronald Reagan, who begins his run for the presidency initially in 1976 when he challenges Ford, this group of conservatives, in some cases we now call them neoconservatives, begin pushing the idea that the Soviet Union is not in decline. The CIA's view at the time was that the CIA, while dangerous, had weaknesses, and that they could be dealt with, and they were desperate for negotiation over arms control and so forth. Now, this new group of conservatives did not want that analysis to prevail. They insisted that the Soviet Union was growing in power, that it had designs on world conquest, that its economy was booming, and that its military could therefore be sustained, and it was expanding at a rapid rate, and the United States needed a renewed Cold War and a major military buildup to prevent what was called then the window of vulnerability. Now, this was the conservative view. It clashed with the CIA's analytical division view. And in 1976, in the midst of this internal Republican fight between Ford being a more moderate Republican and Reagan more conservative, George Bush Sr. was told and supported the idea of letting these neoconservatives into the CIA's analytical division to present and to develop this alternative, more dramatic, more frightening view of the Soviet Union. It became known as Team B. And Team B essentially attacked the analytical division of the agency as being weak and not assessing the danger of the Soviet Union effectively. And that became more, even before Bush left in December of 76, after Carter wins before the Ford administration ends, Bush adopts a more apocalyptic national intelligence estimate on the Soviet strength and intent. And this is what is left for the Carter administration to deal with. Now, this effort to break down the CIA analytical division is renewed in aggressively after Reagan's victory in 1980, both first with the transition period, when the analytical division is accused essentially of treason by some of the incoming Republicans, and then after Casey takes over the agency in 81, he brings in Robert Gates, who was a close supporter of George Bush, who was also implicated, by the way, in the 1980 October Surprise case, and they bureaucratically break down the analytical division of the CIA, especially the Soviet division. And what they create is a renewed fear of the Soviet menace. They exaggerate the danger. They therefore justify a major military buildup. They justify a very aggressive, violent approach to rebellions in Central America, which otherwise might have been seen as civil wars. They become East-West battles. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua are seen as a beachhead for Soviet invasion of the hemisphere. So this very bleak view becomes the U.S. intelligence view. But there are battles within the agency of people trying to prevent these false and exaggerated analyses being presented, but they lose. They lose the battles as we go through the 80s. and many of them are driven from the CIA, and they are replaced with people who will tell the Reagan-Bush administration what it wants to hear. And in one of the ironies of this is that the CIA is blamed by the late 80s for missing the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Reagan is credited with winning the Cold War. The irony is because the CIA didn't miss the collapse of the Soviet Union as much as it was prevented from noticing and alerting the American people and the government to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was in rapid decline for a number of years, but no one at the agency could say so, because to say so would mean they'd be driven from their jobs. So we ended up with this very falsified analysis and an exaggeration of the Soviet power. In effect, Reagan had built up a straw man and then got credit when it fell down. But that was a very important part of our history today, because this myth about Reagan winning the Cold War and having defeated this huge Soviet menace and reversed it, essentially through the war in Afghanistan and the wars in Central America, has become an important element in how this Republican grouping has sustained its power and has sustained its myth with the American people. And many of these same folks, including people like Paul Wolfowitz, who was part of Team B back in 1976, have returned with the second Bush administration. Dick Cheney, who was an important figure in the Ford administration back in the 70s, became a defense secretary under the first George Bush, and then, of course, become vice president under the second George Bush. You have a number of people who learned how to play this game in the 70s and 80s, returning in the first part of this century, and applying many of the same tactics of bullying the CIA's analytical division. Cheney, for instance, would go over to Langley in the months before the invasion of Iraq and essentially pressure these bureaucrats, these CIA analysts, into writing their reports on Iraq in a more alarmist way than they may have felt justified. So the patterns have continued. The way we've perverted and politicized the intelligence has continued. And the results are that the American people have been essentially and consistently misinformed about the threats around them. They've been exaggerated. The threat of the Soviet Union was exaggerated in the 70s and 80s, and the threat of Iraq was exaggerated in the last couple of years. Consequences can be quite severe when false information is acted on by the U.S. government, as we are currently seeing.
One of the things that veteran listeners will find very gratifying in your book is there's considerable discussion in there of the Bulgarian hypothesis, namely that the KGB using Bulgarian surrogates shot the Pope in May of 1981. Veteran listeners to this broadcast will remember the extremely voluminous research that we did on that, proving that was not only so much BS, but that actually there were links between the Grey Wolves, between some of the Operation Gladio and P2-related elements in Italy, and the actual assassination, as well as the subsequent disinformation effort. And again, it's a long subject. We haven't got time to go into it here in this broadcast, but veteran listeners will appreciate that. Dealing with the issue of politicized intelligence, again, one of the points you make is that George Tenet had been very cozy with David Boren, a senator from Oklahoma, am I correct?
Right. David Boren was a senator from Oklahoma and chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the 1990s. Late 80s and early 90s.
And was less than vigorous in some of these investigations, and you imply that actually had something to do with George Tenet's ultimate accession to being Director of Central Intelligence. I wonder, as sort of a wrap-up item for this broadcast, because we only have a few minutes left, maybe 3 minutes left, if you could summarize that for us.
Sure. There was another scandal that was developing in the early 1990s called Iraqgate, and it followed the Persian Gulf conflict. After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, what we began to learn about more was that there had been this secret policy in the 1980s of secretly arming the Iraqis. What the Reagan-Bush administration had been doing effectively was arming both the Iranians and the Iraqis. And some of the equipment used by Saddam, including some used in his chemical warfare operations in the 80s, came through these secret U.S. facilitated contact. Some was through third countries. Now, there was an effort to investigate that in the early 1990s, led by a couple of Democrats in Congress, and it had received some press attention, not as much as it deserved, but some. There was a point when there was a good deal of, there were witnesses coming forward who had participated. The case really went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And one of the key operatives who was in the context of Bob Gates being named by the first George Bush as being CI director in the early 1990s, this became the focus of this investigation of what Gates was doing with Iraq. However, David Boren decided to sweep this under the rug and help Gates get the CIA directorship and get the confirmation through the Senate. And the key staff person working for Boren on this project was George Tenet, and he proved himself very useful in preventing a thorough investigation of Gates's background. He prevented the serious examination, or contributed to the lack of a serious examination of the Iraqgate issue. And that earned him a lot of brownie points. So when it came to, he was appointed, of course, to be CIA director by Bill Clinton at the end of Clinton's administration, but he was kept on in the second Bush administration. And he had, in the meantime, of course, because he was known to the Bush family as someone who would play ball with them. He had proved that back in the early 90s. So you often see these personal relationships evolving in Washington around, especially around these key moments when the Bush family has been most vulnerable and most open to investigation or criticism. The people that have helped them are people they remember. And we see that the way our government has been shaped in the past 20 years has often involved these personal relationships that most Americans don't know about.
And there's a tremendous amount of inertia involved in these relationships and the subsequent unfolding of governmental affairs. And you go into that at great length and in great detail in Secrecy and Privilege. Robert, we are virtually out of time. I'd like to visit with you again and talk about, among other things, the Moon Organization, something that is playing a huge role in American society that doesn't get a lot of publicity. We have been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, currently available, and something that listeners should evaluate as a holiday gift in this season of gift-giving. This concludes Side 2, For the Record, program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.